You talked about the Taliban and kind of the history of Taliban and their involvement in all aspects of the drug trade. I'd be interested in a little more on Al-Qaeda itself and the extent to which you're seeing them involved in the drug trade.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got to be a little bit careful here. The Taliban, let's talk about the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, first of all. It was the Taliban that allowed the Al-Qaeda to flourish in Afghanistan, and it was the heroin and opium trade in Afghanistan that allowed the Taliban to flourish, all right? And that's the most, in that same ungoverned space. And that's the most important thing that I can say. I can tell you that we're seeing more and more unequivocal connections with respect to Al-Qaeda involved in drug trafficking activity. And I've got to end it right there. We've got ongoing investigations, and we're working with lots of other folks on those. And
alrighty. And just, I didn't make this clear at the front, this session is on the record. Just, I know we've had different arrangements for various speeches, but this is on the record. Yes?
Randy Nicholson with Reuters.
Hey, Randy.
I'm wondering, people might look at this.
Hey, Randy, hang on. Can everyone hear Randy in the back, or have we got a mic that's going around? Or okay, hang on.
Okay, what one conclusion people might reach after looking at this presentation and the figures, like the total amount of drug trade versus the amount of cash you've seized.
Right.
And they might view that as an argument for legalization of drugs and government management. What do you see as the impact of that in terms of drying up the oxygen that these groups feed on?
Well, that's a great question, Randy, and I'll tell you what. You know, the old saying is those who are ignorant of history are doomed to repeat it. Most people in our country believe that drug abuse in our country really got its start in a big way in the mid-1960s with the counterculture movement, and that's where it began to flourish, and we're still fighting it today. But the reality of the situation is the worst period in our nation's history was the 40-year period for drug abuse, was the 40-year period after our Civil War. Post-Civil War, there were obviously hundreds of thousands of veterans returning to their homes, almost all terribly, psychologically impacted, and hundreds of thousands horribly physically traumatized. And in those days, you could walk into any drugstore in the United States and you could buy cocaine or a coca-based product. You could buy morphine, heroin, and other opioid-based products off the shelf. Why? Because it was all unregulated back then. And during that period, one in every 200 Americans was addicted to either a cocaine or a coca-based product, or heroin, morphine, or an opioid-based product. So the addiction rates were out of control, and actually that's where the federal drug laws got their start. The hue and cry went out by citizens across the country demanding that the federal government step in and do something about that crisis, and that's really how it all started. And with that said, I'll make one final comment. No matter... Well, I take that back. I'm going to make a couple final comments. I'm passionate about this, folks, after 33 years in this business. But look at any country in the world that's decriminalized drugs, and you'll find that that eventually they go back to recriminalization. We've even experienced that to a degree in the state of Alaska and a couple other states in the United States. And why do they recriminalize? Because academic equivalency or efficiency tests go right through the toilet. Workplace productivity goes right through the bottom. Workplace injuries go right through the ceiling. It tears the moral fiber of families apart, and strong families are the foundation for any strong country. So suffice it to say that it doesn't work. But lastly, if we're going to legalize drugs, Randy, I mean, where do we draw the line? Are we going to legalize methamphetamine, the most hideous drug that I've ever seen in my life that, you know, leads to addiction oftentimes after just two or three episodes of abuse? Are we going to legalize LSD? Or, you know, someone that takes LSD, do you want them, if it's legalized, would you want that person driving your kid to school on the bus the next day? How does the trooper or the deputy handle the situation on the roadside with a roadside accident where we have a breathalyzer that can be administered today for drunken driving, but you would need a search warrant to take a blood sample or a hair sample in most cases to even prove in some way the case of a drugged driver. So it is the most complex of subjects, but if you do your research, you can only reach one decision or conclusion, and that is legalization has never worked and it will never work, and it's got to remain a criminal activity. With that said, do I believe that our government could spend more money on education and treatment? Absolutely. But I'm a law enforcement guy, and I'm in the business of, you know, manning the ramparts as the last line of defense, and that's what we do. So, thanks, though. Good question.
If you could state your name and affiliation and also speak into the mics directly in front of you. Yes. There should be a mic at the table. So.
Hi, I'm Pam Hess. I'm with APM. I'm interested in two things in particular. When you began following the money as it relates to the terrorist organizations, did you find it was harder or easier or just the same to flip them the way that you would do somebody who's just in it for criminal purposes?
It's the same, again, Pam, because they're relying on, you know, the same money laundering infrastructures that, you know, are present around the globe. So following the money on the terrorist side, for us, we don't change our modus operandi really in any way. We just follow it the same way.
And there was a sort of a derisive tone applied to the law enforcement technique of combating terrorism when the administration switched. That was one of the things that the Bush administration said was wrong with the Clinton administration approach. And it almost sounds like you're advocating a bit of a pendulum swing back, and that's certainly one of the parts of COIN strategy, which is leveraging law enforcement to take care of insurgencies. I'm wondering if you think there is a pendulum moving here.
Well, I don't think there's a pendulum moving. I mean, I think that, and this is one of the things that I'm most proud of with respect to our agency. And let me just start this way. You know, as an agency, we learned long before 9/11, how to take information from highly classified sources and programs, sanitize it, and get it into the hands of our local and state counterparts domestically and our foreign counterparts, obviously abroad, so that they can or could intervene at, you know, again, just the right place at just the right time to seize drugs, money, arms, arrest very, very bad people. So as an agency, we didn't really skip a beat, you know, post 9/11. Some agencies, even today, are still struggling somewhat with how to accomplish information sharing. But with that said, I mean, I believe that we've got to have a multifaceted approach. The intelligence community certainly has their hands full, and they're doing great work, and they're doing just what they need to be doing. Our military is doing great work. They've got their hands full, and they're doing yeoman's work at, you know, prosecuting GWAD, and they are the principal prosecutors, one guy's opinion. But law enforcement is also making tremendous contributions. And I'll say this right now, and I mean this with all sincerity. I believe those who are involved in drug law enforcement, whether you be at the local, state, or federal level, are working abroad for some other agency, contribute as much, if not more, day in and day out than any other agencies or departments, with the exception of those men and women in uniform that are in far-off places killing bad guys up close and personal. With the exception of them, I believe that drug law enforcement makes the most significant contribution to GWAT. So how? Well, how is by doing what we're doing day in and day out. We're seizing drugs, which is denying revenue. We're seizing lots of money, obviously revenue, real, okay, revenue. We're arresting some very, very bad people that have formed alliances already with terrorist organizations, and we are arresting terrorists and the facilitators of terrorism, those shadow facilitators that I talked about earlier. It's impossible to track a $20 bill from a heroin buy in Baltimore into the coffers of Al-Qaeda. It's impossible. It'll never happen. But with that said, we know that hundreds of millions of dollars, billions, are making their way back to terrorist organizations. So this is one thing that I can say unequivocally. Every dollar that we seize is a dollar we know will never make its way back into the war chest of a terrorist organization that's hell-bent on destroying our way of life. And that's what we do day in and day out.
So you can't give an estimate?
We want to make sure we get in all the questions.
Sorry.
Hey. Yeah.
Wait, oh, is this the speaker?
Hi, this is Penny Starr with CNS News. I wanted to ask you if there's any evidence of terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda, Hamas, or others involved in drug trafficking that in Mexico or along the U.S.-Mexican border.
Along the U.S.-Mexican border, no, but I can tell you that that we know of. But I can tell you that Hezbollah and Hamas and Hezbollah sympathizers are all over the Western Hemisphere, like they are all over the world, involved in this kind of activity. And we'll just leave it at that. Thanks.
Yes, Karen.
Hi, Aaron Maness. I'm at the University of Maryland. I follow terrorist activity in the greater Middle East. And I just wanted to mention first off that in the open source press there's been a lot of information that indicates the DEA was playing a highly effective role, and this briefing really helped clarify the how and why. Two questions, and the first one will be quick because I'm pretty sure I know the answer. The first one is FARC and Hezbollah. In the open source I read hints, but there's nothing very solid. And the second would be, because you're probably going to say you can't say anything about it, but if you can. The second would be, I'm curious about aerial spraying, which I know isn't what the DEA does, but I'm wondering how it fits into the strategy. I've read some very critical analyses of it, but also some that say that, well, it does force the drug traffickers to sort of defend their territory and reduce their resources. So I'd be curious anything you had to say on that front.
So the first one was FARC and Hezbollah, and you thought I might be able to comment on that one?
I was hoping.
I can't really comment on that. Put it this way, the open source reporting that you obviously have access to is probably fairly accurate. All right. Secondly, with respect to aerial spraying. And I guess you're probably talking about its effectiveness in a place like Afghanistan. So the first thing I've got to tell you is that anywhere in the world, any country, go back in time, look at any of them, source countries that reach a point where policymakers have to make the tough decisions and take it on. It typically takes between 15 to 20 years to get a handle on the threat. The most effective strategies, proven time and time again, have been obviously multifaceted, combinations of enforcement, identifying the biggest, baddest drug cartels and traffickers in whatever country, and bringing them to justice, holding them accountable. That's our role in Colombia or Afghanistan or anywhere else. strong eradication programs. And in a place like Afghanistan, quite frankly, I've spent a lot of time on the ground there. I just don't believe there's going to be a more effective way than aerial spraying. And the third is education. Okay? The three-legged stool. If you don't have, you know, a robust strategy that employs all three of those dimensions or things, then it's just not going to work very well. I want to share, just if I could, just very quickly. It's not related to what you said, but I think Pam, that was your. I think it kind of relates to what you said earlier. And there's a study that was conducted by Stanford University. I'm trying to find out exactly when. In fact, I called my regional director down in Bogota, because he's the guy that told me about this a couple weeks ago and got as much of the information as I could factually. A Stanford University study post 9/11 that looked at worldwide conflicts. They studied 128, I think, like over the last 20 years or so. And of those 128, those that that lasted or appeared to last far longer than any of the others, they identified 17 that kind of fit that category, and then they drilled in and looked at those 17 compared to the others. And they found that those 17, on average, lasted 48 years, five times longer than any other conflicts. And the piece that connected all of those 17 were when the insurgencies or fighters had access to contraband revenue. Okay, drugs, you know, untaxed cigarettes, whatever. And it's interesting to note that the FARC is 44 years old right now, and they're falling apart at the seams. So anyway.
Hi, my name's Daniel Marshall, and I'm with the American Legislative Exchange Council.
The what?
It's a bit of a mouthful, I know. The American Legislative Exchange Council.
Okay.
Before, you were talking how it's very sort of easy to buy cocaine in South America for $5,000 and then sell it in the Middle East, Israel, for much higher price at $70,000 or $75,000.
More like $125,000 plus.
Okay. And you said anything under, typically under 14 kilograms would go underneath your radar. I mean, how easy is it to do that? I would have thought it would have been quite hard to smuggle cocaine on an El Al flight.
Just remember, it doesn't necessarily have to be on an outbound El Al flight, okay? Drug traffickers and smugglers are some of the most cagey individuals that you'll ever, you know, investigate or come up against. And what we know is happening quite often for those kinds of amounts of cocaine headed for Israel, they're not on an outbound El Al flight. They'll be flown to some other part of the world, connected to a common carrier that's, you know, that is also servicing Israel, and they'll come in that way. But the reality of the situation is there's a lot of money to be made in this activity. We're up against very smart adversaries. Those who are moving drugs, whether it be along our southwest border, are moving heroin in dhows on the Makran Strait. Okay, they move drugs today. They move guns tonight. They move aliens tonight. They move, you know, whatever tomorrow. They really don't care. They can move anything, any size, any place in the world, with pinpoint accuracy, and get the job done. No matter how hard we work, that's just the reality of the situation, you know.
Yes.
Kasım Cindemir with Turkish Daily Hürriyet. Here, sir.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Is the PKK involved in drug trafficking? If so, how do they operate? And what are you and your counterparts in Turkey doing against that.
What's your first name? I'm sorry. I met you earlier,
Qasim,
I think.
Qasim,
yeah. Qasim, I was in your country last week. We had the 26th Annual International Drug Enforcement Conference that DEA has hosted for 26 years. In Istanbul, we brought together 91 countries from around the globe, policymaking law enforcement officials from around the globe. And this is the most important thing that we can do with respect to fighting the PKK, the FARC, Al-Qaeda, or anybody else, and that is break down the walls and cooperate and commit to cooperation amongst all countries around the globe, whether we're fighting terrorists or fighting drugs. President Bush just, I think it was a couple months ago, obviously identified the PKK as a terrorist organization and specifically said himself that the PKK was involved in drug trafficking activity, I believe, at a press conference. So they are involved in drug trafficking activity. We're working with our Turkish counterparts and other counterparts in that part of the world to take them on and disrupt and hopefully ultimately dismantle their operations.
Yes.
I'm Christine Day, and I'm from the Migration Policy Institute.
Hey, Christine.
So you spoke a lot about shadow facilitators. Could you speak more in depth about what overlap there might be between terrorist drug trafficking and human smuggling routes in terms of people, that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at any, I don't care where the smuggling routes are around the world, on our southwest border, you have families or groups that control lanes, is what we refer to them, lanes or channels along that southwest border. The drug cartels don't necessarily own that ground. These, and typically we're talking about families that go back for generations that control those lanes. And they control the movement of any, whatever the contraband might be, whether it be guns from the U.S. headed south, or dope headed north, or money headed south from the U.S., massive amounts of money for the payment of drugs. They control those territories. I mentioned the Makran Strait earlier. Those same Dow boat handlers that are moving loads of heroin in the morning, we know are moving arms and terrorists oftentimes at night. So really the smugglers, not only of aliens but arms and other contraband, they are in essence linchpins oftentimes in this whole this whole nefarious activity. And the point that I was trying to make earlier is that this agency places a great deal of attention, as much attention on those shadow facilitators in that great area as we do, you know, drugs themselves or money or the flow of money. So did that answer your question? Okay.
Yes, in the back.
Ali Mansri from Iran Visual News Corp.
Hey, Ali.
You spoke earlier of counterparts.
Uh-huh.
Now, Iran has been recently praised by the UN for its drug seizures.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know, to what level has the DEA been involved in those seizures? And will the DEA be involved in Iran, given the possible sanctions it may face due to its ambition?
Well, because of diplomatic challenges, we're prohibited from working directly with our Iranian counterparts. You know, there's a tremendous addiction rates in Iran. I know that your border police are paying a tremendous price. There are not hundreds but thousands of them who have lost their lives courageously trying to stop the flow of, you know, heroin into the country and precursors and cash out and that kind of thing. And but right now, we're not able to work directly with our Iranian counterparts. Suffice it to say, though, that we have third-party nations that that serve as an interface, if you will. If we've got leads that will help our counterparts in Iran, we'll make sure that they get into their hands, and that's how we work. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
I
use the microphone.
Conflicts and their relations with drug trafficking and terrorist organizations. Is it fair to say that if a conflict, like the Middle Eastern conflict, comes to an end, do you see Hezbollah and Hamas eventually getting out of the drug trafficking market? On the flip side, do you see an engagement, with political engagement with these groups, who are determined to get into drug trafficking?
No, I don't see it coming to an end. I believe, I believe Hezbollah and Hamas have both crossed into that that hybrid category, as far as I'm concerned, where they're one part terrorist organization, one part drug trafficking organization. And quite frankly, when they do that, in many ways, and this is important for people to understand this around the globe, their ideology kind of goes out the window when they get a taste for the money, and it all becomes It's all about greed. It's all about turf at that point, and that's what's driven organized crime around the globe. You know, for the last my God, who knows how long? All right, I don't see it changing. I see more and more of these organizations making this evolution to kind of the next step, and I believe strongly that again, what we're seeing is a face of 21st century organized crime. And it's meaner and uglier than anything that we've ever faced before, that most militaries have probably faced before, or intelligence services.
Do you put PKK on the hybrid category?
PKK?
Yeah.
I wouldn't go that far right now, but yeah.
Yes.
Hang on one second. Did you say PKK? No. I'm sorry. I thought you said something else. PKK? Yeah. Yeah, they're there. I'd call them a hybrid. Yeah. They're smack dab in the middle of drug trafficking and other transnational organized crime. And they are a designated terrorist organization. Yeah.
I'm one of those liaison officers you refer to.
Yeah. Okay.
If you could use the mic, it's hard to hear you up here.
Yeah, I we can barely hear you. Maybe a little bit closer. There you go. You're on it now, rock star.
Because of the increased focus on terrorism since 9/11, especially with the U.S., do you think that some of the drug trafficking organizations have managed to profit in more ways than one and find the radar when it comes to focus of the U.S. or
Yeah, that's a great question, and I have seen some things that concern me. Your first name again? I'm sorry. I've seen some things that concern me. this absolute focus on physical security and ensuring physical security is a wonderful thing. All right, you know what folks need to be very concerned about. You know, are people moving through our airports, into or through our airports with weapons, biological weapons that could be unleashed on an aircraft? I mean, you know, whatever the case might be, that's what they're focused on. But we can't turn away from traditional threats as well, like drugs. You know, if you stop and think about it, and I believe you would agree with me, you know, if someone was able to smuggle an ounce of PCP powder onto an aircraft and suddenly unleash that in the air through the ventilation system, what do you think happens? Those kinds of things worry me, and I'm concerned that we have, in many ways, we have turned from focusing on traditional threats to, you know, these new threats post 9/11. And we're not paying attention to detail like we should be paying attention to detail. I think I answered your question. Okay.
And I actually wanted to ask one final question.
Okay.
You talked a lot about the hybrid organization. One official that I've spoken to said that particularly the Taliban, with they're spending so much time at this point on drug trafficking related activities that it's actually in some ways distracted them from their insurgency mission. And I was curious to hear your thoughts on whether or not you've seen any of that. I mean, you mentioned the greed and the focus on that. Has that in any cases shifted attention away from terrorism, away from insurgency, and more towards the money-making aspects?
I don't believe so. I think what you're saying is it tying any of them up? Is it tying up big numbers of Taliban and causing them to be focused on, you know, security at labs and things like that? No. We, on any given day of the week, we've got lots of DEA folks on the ground in Afghanistan who are involved in counter-narcotics operations strongly supported by U.S. MIL, by the intelligence community, not only our assets but coalition partners from NATO, ISAF, and we're not seeing that. We're not.